This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Book Waves Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. My guest is Margot Livesey, whose latest novel is The Road from Belhaven. Earlier novels include The Boy in the Field, Mercury, The Missing World. There are 10 novels in all. There's also recently, and we'll be discussing this, The Hidden Machinery, which are essays about writing, because Margot Livesey also teaches at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. But first, let's talk a little about what happened after the last time I interviewed you, which was for Mercury. At the time, now my memory may be shot on this, but at the time I remember you talking about writing a novel about your grandmother or great-grandmother in Scotland. That novel didn't show up in 2020. Instead, we got a different novel called The Boy in the Field, but now we have The Road from Belhaven. You finished the tour for Mercury. You're thinking about the book that became The Road from Belhaven, but that was 2016. What happened at that point to put you into a different book, which was kind of a literary detective novel?
Someone who had gone to the boys' half of the girls' school I went to got in touch with me. I hadn't seen him for many decades, we won't say how many, and he told me a story about why he had changed his mind about being a doctor. And he changed his mind about being a doctor because one sunny afternoon he had come home from school, I mean high school, to his tiny village and where no one locked their doors. And this was in Scotland. Everything is in Scotland. There are just a few things that happen in other places. Anyway, he'd come home to his house and in his garden he had found a girl who'd been murdered. He was in her presence for maybe 10 seconds, but those 10 seconds convinced him he could never be a doctor, and he went on to become an accountant. And I found that story of how his life had jumped the tracks, had gone in another direction, so interesting that it lured me away from my grandmother. And I decided to write about three teenagers coming home from school one afternoon and finding not a dead girl, but a wounded boy.
So it kind of intruded on what you were doing. Had that happened before?
It has happened before, and sometimes I fight back and say, no, I'm going to stay with this. But the novel about my great-grandmother was in a very fledgling state, and so it was easy to be lured away. And I had also read a wonderful interview with a detective writer, Louise Walsh, who talked about how, why do we love detective stories? Why do we love murder and mayhem? And she argues that it's because the detective goes down into the valley of shadow and brings back order, brings back harmony. And following the election of 2016, I was perhaps particularly interested in ideas of order and harmony.
Talk about weird synchronicities. I'm starting to prepare an interview with people over at Pacific Film Archive about a director named Agnes Varda.
Oh, a wonderful director.
And one of the movies she made was called Vagabond, which opens with a dead girl in a ditch.
Yes.
Did that come up in your mind when all this was going on?
You know, until this moment, I would have said no, but it is a film that I know and admire enormously, so perhaps yes.
When you're working on something like that, as opposed to a novel which kind of has an outline of sorts, which is Road from Belhaven, when you're working on a novel and you have an idea, okay, these three siblings find a body, and they go in their directions. How thought out is it before you sit down and begin writing?
Not very thought out. I knew I was going to use some of the aspects of the traditional English detective novel. There was going to be a detective working away in the background to solve the crime, and one of the siblings becomes a kind of amateur detective. But my main thought was about the idea of their lives going in different directions. And so the youngest sibling, who's adopted, looks for his birth mother. And the middle sibling looks for her romantic partner, if you will.
How much rewriting do you do?
A horrible amount. I mean, I have an adopted brother in London who's a tree planter. And I praise his name because I put so much paper in recycling. I rewrite massively.
Does that mean that you're writing by hand?
Not as much these days, but I go back and forth at different stages, but mostly, like many people, I do write on a computer.
At that point, were you also working on Hidden Machinery? Was that going on at the same time? Were the essays written over time then?
The essays were very much written over time, along with other essays that I decided not to put in the book. I really wanted the book to be coherent and to have a coherent idea, the idea that in the works we love, there is this hidden machinery at work that is powering them, and that it's the job of the artist to conceal the machinery. And I tried to make the essays follow that idea, even if sometimes in a rather labyrinthine way.
The book comes out, The Boy in the Field, in August 2020. Now, that means suddenly, 4 years ago, everything shuts down. So there was no tour, and honestly, I never heard of the book.
I know. It was not, of course, at all what my publisher or I had hoped for. I did do quite a number of events on Zoom, and I did find that there was a renaissance, if you will, of book clubs, that many, many book clubs wanted to meet with me. What were people doing during COVID? They were gardening and walking and reading and, you know, going on Zoom. So it was a wonderful time for a certain kind of conversation, even though I missed the intimacy of face-to-face conversations.
The essay book had been published, and you were still writing essays?
Yes, the essays I write are nearly always for an occasion. Somebody invites me to a conference or invites me to give a talk, and I pull myself together and try to focus my ideas into an essay. And I think one of the things I love about writing essays is that it helps me get my thinking to a higher level. I mean, even if they didn't benefit anybody else, I would be very grateful for that.
Then let me ask you, okay, you put together the essay collection, it's published after Mercury, and you have to go through it over and over. Did the essays themselves change either Mercury or the two following novels, having read them again?
I think I would say that the essays did change The Boy in the Field and The Road from Belhaven in a number of respects. I actually found myself in the odd position of trying to take my own advice, of trying to do the things I urge my students to do, and I hope that was beneficial.
Can you think of any clear examples in either of the books where reading the essay made you go, let me try this?
I would say that one thing I talk about is, in novels in particular, is the sin of irrelevance. And I did particularly work in both The Boy in the Field and The Road from Belhaven to try to make sure that every scene was taking the reader to a new place, that it wasn't just repeating the same psychological message, if you will.
It's interesting, the sin of irrelevance, because you see that all the time in poetry where every word has to be deliberate. But this is different. It's not even repeating a scene. It's repeating the point of the scene.
Yeah, it's, you know, having the father be disagreeable over and over again, or in my case, having Duncan, the youngest sibling in the boy in the field, tell us over and over how much he wants to be a painter. It's crucial information, but we don't need to hear it many times. What we need is for it to sort of infuse his personality and the way he goes through the world.
So in Road from Belhaven, it would be the grandfather being hard toward her, particularly after the events, which we don't want to go into too far. But that sort of thing?
Very much that sort of thing. I really did not want him to be an archetypal, stern patriarch. I feel that there are enough characters like that in Scottish literature, indeed in literature in general, stern white men.
Let's come back to Belhaven at this point. So now you're holed up at home. Your book has been published, and I would assume that in 2019 you were kind of fiddling around with Road to Belhaven at that point. But you hadn't made a trip to Scotland at that point, or had you?
In 2019, I go back to Scotland two or three times a year. But really, I think, propelled me to write The Road from Belhaven was, in fact, the events of March 2020, when I suddenly realized I couldn't go back except in my memory and imagination. And so I wanted to write a novel that was as Scottish as I could make it. And The Road from Belhaven is that novel.
In the afterword, you list a number of books you read, but it's also true that having grown up there in an era which is very different from today, and I was there in 1971, and I passed through Glasgow, and the entire city was black from the coal. And in 2017, I was back there again, and it wasn't. It's very different. So it was very different growing up, but that difference, was that difference, you think, a little bit less in some ways than the difference between then and now? I mean, between 1880s and 1950s, let's say, if you weren't in the city.
I think the rate of change, according to the older people in my life, has vastly accelerated in the last 20 years or so. And growing up, we did not have a telephone, a refrigerator, or a television until I was, I think, 9 or 10. So in many ways, many things in the house, I mean, we did have electricity and electric light, but many things were happening in the house much as they had for 100 years.
Now, Belhaven is a real place. Or no, not. It's close to a real place.
It's an imaginary place, which unfortunately, such are the workings of one's unconscious, I named after a rather famous Scottish brewery.
If you could pinpoint fictional Belhaven, where would it be?
Belhaven is in the Kingdom of Fife, as it's called. It's not terribly far from St. Andrew's University, made famous by members of the royal family. It's not terribly far from a market town called Cooper, which is still a market town. So you could almost find it on the map, but not quite.
From what I could tell, if you go to the Firth of Forth, in one direction you hit Glasgow and the other direction Edinburgh, is that correct?
That's correct.
So you could take a ship from one to the other.
No, because the Firth of Forth, you used to be able to. There was a canal, but that is no longer operational. But you can sail from Edinburgh across the Firth of Forth to the Kingdom of Fife. And if you walked north after you landed, you would find Lizzie's farm. You would find Belhaven Farm.
In the 1880s, it wasn't a very long train ride to Glasgow, but it was far enough so that there wasn't that much contact.
The late 18th century was a wonderful era of railway expansion in Scotland, but That didn't mean that people took trains casually. You had to have a real purpose to go somewhere. You didn't go sightseeing or exploring.
So let's go back to your mother's stories about her mother and grandmother. When you began thinking about the road from Belhaven, you used one element, which is something your grandmother had, which was some kind of foresight. Was your mom specific about how it worked for Liz, that you were able to use it for Lizzie?
I'm going to offer a correction here. My mother, Eva, who I wrote about in a novel called Eva Moves the Furniture, had a strong relationship with the supernatural. But because she died when I was 2.5, she didn't pass on any of that information to me. The things I know about my great-grandmother, Lizzie Craig, come from my newly discovered Australian relatives, whom I went to visit in 2017. And they were the ones who told me about Lizzie's second sight and how she could sometimes see the future, but not in reliable ways. I mean, what she saw was truthful, but she couldn't arrange to see it.
When I interviewed you, when you were talking about it, you had no idea of that.
No.
So that came later.
Yes.
So how did you find out about your mother's connection to the supernatural?
Several people told me stories about her. She was a nurse. Some of them had been her patients. And what they told me was that she was a lovely nurse, but it was very hard to get a good night's sleep in the wards where she worked because the poltergeists would come and move the furniture around in the night. And she would come in the morning and put everything to rights. So that was one example of her relationship with the supernatural. And she also saw people who were not visible to most other people.
How do you, Margot Livesey, take that, put that in your head?
Well, one of the things I struggle with, Richard, is that my mother had a relationship with the supernatural, and my great-grandmother had a relationship with the supernatural. But I don't seem to. I'm still hoping it might show up, but not so far.
How about other members of your family?
Well, I come from a tiny family. My parents were both only children. And as far as I know, nobody else has these gifts. But I must ask my Australian relatives more and find out if that's true.
You knew a little about it, but of course, the drawings she makes, that's all coming from you.
Yes. One of the things that made Lizzie Craig a particularly inviting character to write about was that I didn't know too much. I know quite a lot about my grandmother, and although her story is exciting, it feels overdetermined. It feels like I would know the end too clearly. Whereas with Lizzie Craig in The Road from Belhaven, I had a destination for the novel, but I really had to invent the road by which we would reach it.
Which is the road in the book. You have her going to Glasgow and taking on several jobs. A single woman showing up in Glasgow at that point would be very scary, I would think, even though she had a quote-unquote boyfriend.
I think it was very scary. It was also, I think, exciting. I mean, one of the things about the enormous industrialization of the second part of the 19th century, I think in America and in Britain, was that finally people had some choices. You could grow up in the countryside and you could move to the town or the city. There was a certain kind of job that hadn't existed before. And in Glasgow, two large industries were the enormous shipyards and the enormous Singer sewing machine factory. Now, Lizzie, my character, doesn't work in either of those, but they were driving the mechanism of the city.
Well, what about the place where she did work? where she was drawing things. That existed?
That did exist. I have to confess, I don't know if it existed in Glasgow, but it was a job that I discovered by reading a wonderful newspaper called the Girls' Own Magazine, actually, which was published, I think, monthly in the 1870s and 80s. And they had essay competitions, and one essay competition was describe a day in your job, describe a day at work. And one of the winners described her day as a locomotive tracer, and that was what alerted me to this job.
I was fascinated by that because it was women, and it was women artists, and they were doing kind of weird stuff, which is almost outlining, drawing outlines of what already existed. But it's art, and it's women doing it. It's a job that kind of floored me. You must have floored you, too.
I found it quite thrilling to read about this quite skilled job, as you say, being done by women. And, you know, they were very much essential intermediaries between architects is not the right word, but between sort of engineers of various kinds, helping to design these locomotives and make these very precise drawings.
Well, she also worked at a pub.
Yes.
And she worked for a rich old lady very briefly. And in that, I guess, more research in the various books on what it was like to work in a pub?
The pub, I think, is probably a place where I took more liberties, in that I don't think women traditionally did a great deal of work in pubs, unless they were married to the publican, as it were. But the job of housemaid was very well documented in Victorian England, Victorian Britain, so I had a lot of information about that. And the pleasures of the servants often had a kind of community that paralleled, I suppose, upstairs, downstairs is a very well-known example of that.
Were there any jobs that you discovered that you were going to give to Lizzie but didn't?
I don't think there were, but I did discover things that I did not include in the novel because they seemed too, I don't know, maybe too problematic. For instance, I found in the newspaper descriptions of a Chinese man who was working as a juggler in Glasgow. And I found that extremely interesting. I mean, what sort of life could have brought him to Glasgow, which at that time was largely, but not entirely, white? There were people of colour there. But I worried that something like that would somehow derail the novel slightly. And I decided regretfully to put it in recycling.
The job of a tailor. You did research on that.
I did quite a bit of research on tailors, and my great-grandfather was a tailor. He ended up making the kilts for the Brisbane Pipe Band in Australia. So he made suits and kilts.
The life of anybody in Scotland, probably anywhere, unless you were very rich, it's a very hard life. Get up early, work under difficult conditions, have very few breaks, wind up, if you're going to get anywhere, being almost like an indentured servant. What was going on in your mind when you were writing about these tough lives for people?
I think partly I was thinking back to the people I knew in my childhood. As a child, there were 4 years when I visited a farm every day. It was owned by a brother and sister who seemed to have come out of a William Trevor novel, and they had inherited the farm from their parents, and I believe from their grandparents, and it was basically unchanged since the 1850s. And so that was the model for Belhaven Farm, and Chrissy and Selby just worked every day. That was their lives. They never took a day off. Sunday was a little bit different. I don't think they went to church, but they were a bit more leisurely on Sunday. But otherwise, it was just unceasing.
Was there a reason why you created a farm that had a little house nearby? I mean, other than the fact that obviously you used it, was that something that was normal?
It was quite common, at least in Scottish farms and perhaps south of the border as well, you know, to have people like your cowman or some kind of farm worker, maybe your bailiff if it was a big farm, living nearby, living near the main farmhouse.
It's not in the book. Was there any actual talk in those times about politics, about the lives they led in terms of politics, strikes, anything like that? Or was that just something that they didn't even think about?
I think there was probably quite a lot of talk about politics. The Irish famine, you know, which was happening in the 1840s, it also happened in Scotland. The same potato blight affected farmers in Scotland. So there was considerable awareness of that. There was huge Scottish immigration in the 19th century to Canada, to Australia. And there was concerns about the government in Westminster in London being so far away and not really being concerned with what was going on in Scotland. So I think there was probably quite a lot of political conversation.
But it wouldn't have affected someone like Lizzie, who kind of just trying to live day to day, I would guess.
I think it would, if she had gone to work in one of the factories, it would have perhaps played more of a role. But because she goes into a private house and then into the drawing you describe, the locomotive tracing, it has less of an effect on her. And again, I think that was one of the things that I really wanted The Road from Belhaven to be a fairly short novel. I didn't want it to have too much baggage in it. So some of the things I discovered, I just decided not to put in about the politics and the unrest and people beginning to organize in terms of labor and to think in terms of getting better wages and better working conditions.
Do you think that part of your rationale could have been that at the time, as today, there is so much talk of politics that the idea of bringing that into the novel when you're, in a way, trying to get away?
I hadn't thought of that before, but I have read a number of novels which will remain nameless, in which I feel like there's a character who's just willed into having a certain kind of ideology. And I really did not want to give that to any of my characters. it was tempting to make Hugh, the farm boy who moves to Glasgow, more political, but I resisted that. And I will say that I think that's an astute comment, because I did think of The Road from Belhaven as being a kind of turning away from the incivility, if you will, of public life at the moment on both sides of the Atlantic. I was really trying to write a novel in which no one would swear.
One question, and I'm going to try to phrase this in a way that works. In the novel, there is an unwed mother. What kind of research did you do, and what did you learn in particular about what life would be like for an unwed mother?
I did quite a lot of research on that, because my initial ideas about it came very much from fiction and came on really from the propriety of Victorian fiction, which is always, except for Wuthering Heights, is fairly upright and moral. And then if people aren't moral, as in, say, Tess of the D'Urbervilles, terrible things happen. But my research suggested that actually there was much more flexibility and much more accommodation, that especially in smaller towns and villages, people accepted that these things happened. People hoped that they could be made right. People weren't putting their sons and daughters out on the street.
Well, that was the thing I noticed, is that everybody seemed to have the attitude of, okay, this is life. What are we going to do now? Ranging from, is there a way to get rid of it, to, if you have it, what are you going to do? And where is the baby going to be?
And that very much reflects my reading in the way that people did think about these things. On the one hand, they went to church and they were God-fearing and upright, and there were the Ten Commandments. On the other hand, there was real life, and many, many families had someone who wandered off the narrow road of the Ten Commandments.
When I mentioned get rid of it, you shook your head. Was that not part of it? I remember a line or two which seemed to indicate that it could be in the book.
That was something I have to say I did not find in my research. So I am just going more on my own imagining there. I think that was why I was shaking my head.
Well, it's also true that you had midwives, and midwives would know such things.
Yes, and there was every village had somebody who was a knowledgeable person, whether she was officially a midwife or not.
Margot Livesey, now we're going to go back to your work as a teacher of writing. Do you discuss the notion of plotting? How do you keep a reader reading?
I think of how you keep a reader reading as being the vital, the crucial question of fiction, because we don't read fiction, you know, it's not like the instructions for how to use a microwave. We don't read fiction because we have to. We read fiction because we usually want to. And so I feel that the idea of entertaining the reader in the best possible way is paramount in fiction writing. And I do try to talk to my students about the many varieties of suspense. I don't mean that every novel has to be a whodunit or a thriller or that by any means, but I do remember the advice of Walter Mosley, the mystery writer, who said to me at one point he thought every novel should have a mystery in it. Not necessarily a crime, but something mysterious, something we wanted to find out. And I think of that as very good advice.
I notice now that I'm reviewing plays that a lot of plays deal with a secret that later comes out. And I would guess that on some level, that's always somewhere, even if you don't quite get it. I mean, it's in The Road from Belhaven, for example.
Yes, and I think I use the word secret rather sparingly nowadays because I feel it's become rather common currency. But I do think the idea that we are going to discover something or learn something or go deeper into a character or find a character faced with a very confounding choice, all those things are propulsive and make us want to turn the pages.
And that happens here with Lewis, her sort of boyfriend, where she doesn't quite know what's going on, and of course neither does the reader.
No, and I worked, I wanted to suggest something that the mother of a dear friend once said to me, which I thought was just so helpful. She said, everyone has a secret sorrow. And I think of that in life, when I meet people who are perhaps difficult or not easy to connect with, and I think of it in trying to create characters that my characters should have a secret sorrow, something we don't know, or something that changes our judgment of them.
In writing a character that has a secret, I mean, that's tough because you have to write around something to such a degree that the character is always true to that character, but the reader is not going to pick up on it.
No, it is a very perplexing thing. And of course, what makes it perplexing in part are the ways in which we can be the last people to understand something crucial about ourselves. That, you know, we're often, the self is terra incognita, it's the unknown territory, and we can be quite quick to judge our friends or to think we understand them or can explain them, but we ourselves are creatures of mystery.
Is that where you come up with something like an unreliable narrator?
I I think that's connected to unreliable narrators. I think my narrator in The Road from Belhaven is a fairly truthful narrator.
Right. When I spoke with Alice McDermott, I asked her a question that came up in theater, and she gave her own answer. My friend that I go with wants to be moved by a play. Mm. There's an artistic director in San Francisco who thinks that theater is all about empathy. He calls it an empathy gym. Now, when I asked Alice, I got her answer. What is your answer? Where do you place that in a novel? And do you think it's different for theater?
Unlike Alice, I have never tried to write a play. So I go to the theater for all kinds of reasons. I mean, I come back to, I think it was to Tolstoy's definition of what art is, that one of the ambitions, the aims of art is to give the reader an experience that they haven't had in real life, to make them feel that they've had this experience. And so to that degree, I think we're always hoping that the reader will, if not exactly empathize with the characters, enter into their situations.
And what about being moved on some emotional level as well?
I think creating emotion in fiction is one of the hardest things to do. And, you know, if you go too far in one direction, you get sentimentality or kitsch. And if you go too far in the other direction, you get a kind of frigidity. And somehow negotiating between these two is part of the balancing act of fiction.
Well, how do you do it?
I usually overwrite terribly. I put in many too many sentences, and then I take away as many as I possibly can.
How do you shut off that little voice that's going, this is too much, this is too much?
I don't think I do shut it off, but I have a wonderful reader in my friend Andrea Barrett, the author of a number of fabulous books, most recently Natural History, and she is the one who stands over me and says, too much, Margot.
In The Hidden Machinery, among the essays you have Austin, you have Wolfe, there's also Stoppard. Why is Stoppard there?
I mean, Tom Stoppard is a playwright for whom I have great admiration. And I think one of the things I talk about with my students is how dialogue in fiction is very different from dialogue in a play, and that we, as fiction writers, are the only ones who get to write a certain kind of dialogue that has speech, but also has gestures, interruptions, setting. I mean, these things are indicated by a playwright, but they're not part of the text in quite the same way as, and it's up to us to embody our dialogue and to allow the reader to understand the subtext that's going on beneath the dialogue.
When I look at a play, sometimes I'm going, this dialogue doesn't seem to make sense. And that, I guess, is what you're talking about, because when you're writing, it has to make sense.
Either it has to make sense, or it has to delight or entertain or intrigue the reader. I mean, even if we don't get the dialogue the first time, we need to be interested.
Margot Livesey, can you teach someone to write?
I have the good fortune to teach in a wonderful writing program, the Iowa Writers Workshop, and I have many very talented students. I don't think I can teach them to write exactly, but I can teach them quite a lot of things, or I can help to bring them to certain things. I can help them to understand more clearly what is their material. I can help them to learn how to structure a story or structure a novel. I can help them to figure out how to write a scenes. I can talk to them about rhythm. I can talk to them about setting the level of detail in their work. So there are all kinds of ways in which I do feel I can be truly helpful. But, you know, the crucial thing is something they learn, and I think they learn from each other. You know, that part of going to a good writing program is finding your peers.
I have spent 30 years trying to figure out this three-word question. Maybe you could help me. What is voice?
I think voice is the intersection of language, material, and sensibility. We probably would not recognize Hemingway's famous voice, for instance, if the narrative was about daycare, because Hemingway's voice is also identified with a certain subject matter and a certain angle on that subject matter. So I think we have to include all three things.
Well, when you're talking about voice, I was trying to kind of explain it, say, in terms of whether a director in film has a voice or not. And it seems to me sometimes, like we were mentioning Agnes Varda, it's pretty clear that there is. But other times, if you're talking about, say, Michael Curtiz and the old Warner Brothers, you don't get that. But if you could narrow it a little further, when we're talking about voice, what particularly are we talking about?
If I had to give a three-word answer, I would say voice is attitude.
Attitude. The attitude of the prose, the attitude of the writer?
The attitude of the prose, the attitude of the writer, the attitude of the characters, the angle at which the author stands to the universe.
Well, when you're writing first person, voice becomes easier because it's coming out of that character. You're almost channeling the character. When you're writing third person close, it's sort of the same thing. But if you're writing third person omniscient, how do you do it?
In my case, with difficulty, in The Road from Belhaven, I use a larger, more omniscient third-person voice some of the time, and then some of the time I use a much more intimate third-person voice that's very close to Lizzie. And one of the challenges, I think, about writing about a younger character is making clear that you're not writing for younger readers. So I think it's important to have that adult, larger sensibility.
Is there a difference between writing for younger readers or writing for adult readers?
At the moment, it's a fairly small distinction because there are great young adult writers out there. I mean, doing amazing work. But I think there is something about the psychological complexity, perhaps, and the depth is still something that we see in adult, so-called adult fiction, if you will. But I will say, you know, like many teenagers, I mean, I was reading, you know, Middlemarch and Great Expectations and the way we were now and, you know, all those great books.
Well, when I was a teenager, I think I was reading Lord of the Rings over and over and over again and over again. Lots of science fiction. Years ago, my late co-host, Richard Lupoff, who you met back in the 90s, was talking about what he called boy books and girl books. Books either written, mostly written by women, though could be read by men. Books written by men, which could be read by women. But he thought there was a distinct difference about the writer and the reader. Is that true, or was he just of a different generation?
There may be some truth in it, but I resist that truth because, I mean, for many years I read really entirely without thinking about the gender of the author. I didn't really know there were authors. There were books.
Right.
But I didn't know where they came from. So it didn't occur to me that one book was written by Robert Louis Stevenson and one book was written by Charlotte Bronte. I read the books as gifts, you know, as enthralling adventures. There are books that definitely are trying to seduce the so-called women reader. And there are probably books that are trying to play more to a certain kind of male reader. But there are many books that I think are meant to embrace everyone.
I listened to him when he would talk about that. And of course, again, different generation, born in 1935. And then I was thinking, how do you call someone like Margaret Atwood a girl writer or a boy writer? It just didn't make any sense to me.
No, and I think Margaret Atwood, if she were here, would be denouncing denouncing you, Richard.
Well, I don't think he would have said that to her. We did interview her together several times. Yeah. I also wonder whether back then there was more of a distinction than there is now.
I don't know quite what to think about that. I mean, when, for instance, our great popularizer Dickens was hard at work, publishing his magazine Household Words, serializing his own novels, reaching as many readers as he possibly could, there were also people who were writing, you know, the slang phrase is sort of penny dreadfuls, you know, romantic, racy novels, aimed in many cases at the young women who were working in the newly established factories of the day or in the large houses of the day as housemaids. For a long time, there have been these sort of two layers in writing, as it were, with many people always going back and forth, really. Certainly Dickens followed Dr. Johnson's advice, you know, no one but a fool ever wrote except for money.
I was also thinking more in terms of, say, genre fiction, particularly the difference between a man writing a mystery in those days and a woman writing a mystery in those days. Yeah. And I think that's disappeared as women have fully integrated back into society where they always should have been.
No, I would really agree with that. I mean, we had writers like Dorothy Sayers and Agatha Christie writing mysteries, but in each case they had a male detective. That was absolutely necessary. And now we have wonderful writers writing the mysteries who done it, like, say, Tana French, or for instance, and you know, many of the strongest characters are women.
This is a kind of touchy subject, but what do you think when people charge someone with the idea after writing a book of cultural appropriation?
Like many people, I probably find this a very complicated idea because imagination has always been part of the fiction writer's territory. I greatly value that many, many more people are speaking for themselves. How do I feel about the idea that, say, The Red Badge of Courage, Hart Crane's Civil War novel, it could not now be written by someone like Hart Crane who never went near the Civil War?
Right.
You need credentials for certain kinds of experience. Yes. And I find that a complicated idea. You know, I think one reason that perhaps quite a number of younger writers are turning to speculative fiction of various kinds is because it does feel complicated to write about contemporary life in a way that approximately does justice to it.
It's a tough question. It's a very, very tough question.
Very tough question.
I interviewed the late Peter Brook, mm-hmm. and I asked him, and a local artistic director said to me, isn't Mahabharata cultural appropriation? Mm-hmm. He was like 98 or 99 mm-hmm. or 100. I mean, the Brook was old. Yeah. He just looked and said, that's bull. He said, nobody would have known about the Mahabharata if not for me. We're living in very tough political time. Margot Livesey, does that make you more or less interested in writing about the time we're living in?
I'm having written a novel that goes back more than 100 years. I am very interested in writing about contemporary times. And I think one of the things that I find is that people used to be able to set their novels in sort of some vague idea of the present. It wasn't really dated. And I think that's no longer possible, that we have really since in this century, we have a keen sense that the date really matters. So in the novel I'm attempting to write now, I've picked a very specific date for a very specific reason, and I'm trying to negotiate with that.
When you talk about a specific date, do you have to include the pandemic?
There are quite a number of pandemic novels. I mean, Sigrid Nunez's wonderful The Invulnerables, for instance, comes immediately to mind. And Michael Cunningham's Day also. I think if you're writing about recent times, you probably have to nod towards the pandemic. It was such a big experience. It was such a widely shared experience, probably the experience that most people have shared since the Second World War, say, you know. So I think it is fairly crucial to write about it if you're writing something set post-2020.
The book you're working on now, how far are you?
I'm floundering around 100 pages.
You've been listening to an interview with Margot Livesey, whose latest novel is The Road from Belhaven, and The Hidden Machinery, Essays on Writing, as well as The Boy in the Field, are both available in paperback. Special thanks to Elaine Petricelli and the folks at Book Passage Bookstore in Corte Madera, California, where this interview was originally recorded. Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.